Hey, good afternoon, everyone. This is Love, Life, and Pursuit of FI with your host, Austin Culp.
And Greg Gaskin.
And today we have special guest, Don Brennan. Hey. Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good, Austin. How are you?
I'm good. It's a beautiful day out here in Charlotte because it's raining.
I know. So you must have a different North Carolina than I do because it's kind of gloomy.
So today we have Dawn, who is in real estate for most of her career. Dawn, you're a realtor, correct? Is there any other things that you do outside of your realtor?
I'm a dabbler, so pretty much everything is really related. So, you know, once I kind of went full-time into real estate, everything's been centered around that. But, you know, I invest and I do some private lending, do some flipping. I had a property management company for a long time, but we actually just sold that, so I'm not doing that anymore. So all real estate stuff.
But what kind of was your drive to get into real estate?
Oh, the drive to not want to be poor. So I was a psych major when I was in college, and you know, I worked in the social services field directly out of school and realized how little everybody in social services makes. And, you know, even if I went on to get a master's or a PhD, my income would just be super, super limited. So you know, I talked to my dad about that, and he was kind of, you know, a serial entrepreneur when I was growing up, and he was also in the military, and he encouraged me to get my real estate license. So I, you know, did that at night while I worked during the day. And, you know, once I completed the licensing courses, I got my license and then took on a job as an assistant, selling new homes in a neighborhood. So we had, you know, two main agents, and then I was just their assistant that helped them figure out how to send emails with attachments and that kind of stuff. So.
Okay. So how long have you been doing real estate for?
It has been almost 20 years. So next month will be, next month will be 20 years. Yikes.
Wow.
Wow.
It's a long time to be doing real estate. Do you have any tips for me?
You know, I think, so now I've kind of seen two market shifts now. So, you know, I was selling real estate during the last boom, and, you know, then 2008 rolled around and we hit a recession, and, you know, I kind of just watched things fall apart. And it was interesting because, you know, I work, like I said, I started off as an assistant. So the people I worked for made tons of money in real estate. I was just kind of making a very average, normal salary. You know, I think my best year in real estate before the crash, you know, I was maybe making $60,000. I maybe made that for 1 or 2 years. So, and then the crash happened. And, you know, what I really learned from kind of watching everybody around me was to, you know, save when you're making a lot of money, and then just hold on to that and make sure you really invest in stuff, because in real estate, there are a lot of cycles and, you know, lots of ups and downs. So when you hit those downs, you need to be prepared for them and, you know, understand that that is going to happen. You know, real estate is going to go down at some point. It's also going to go up at some point. So, you know, you just have to make sure you're in the right cycles.
Okay.
Do you see, so like we're entering a down cycle kind of right now, but do you foresee like in the near future anything as bad as like 2008?
I don't think so. You know, in 2008, everybody was able to buy a house and nobody had any kind of skin in the game, you know, versus this time around, it was much harder to get a loan. You know, if you're an investor, you needed to put 20-25% down, where before that, you know, people were getting, you know, no down payment loans, interest only loans and stuff. And, you know, it was just a really, you know, it's just very unqualified people are getting houses. So I think it will be a little bit different this time around. Also, the last recession was like a banking crisis, which obviously included mortgages as well. So I don't think it'll be so bad, but I'm prepared for it to be bad. So we'll see.
Okay. So you invest in real estate yourself as well, correct? So during these times of like a downturn market, do you have any recommendations of where you can still find deals at? Is there like foreclosure markets that you go to, or any tips or tricks?
Yeah, I mean, so the market that I'm in, even when we were going through the worst of the recession, was not overly bad, you know, when you kind of compare it to how some of the other parts of the United States were faring. You know, I know my business partner, she had a house in Arizona that she had to let go into foreclosure. I think she ultimately ended up short selling it, but I think she had paid like $350 for it. And she said it's maybe worth $150. So, you know, just the length of time it was going to take to get that equity back just really made no sense to keep the house. And at that point, you know, we were like, would you ever get the equity back? Will it ever, you know, reach that price again? And you know, assumably it did after COVID, but I really have no idea. I'm sorry, what was the question?
What are some good places to find deals during the down market?
So, you know, so we didn't have a ton of short sales and foreclosures and stuff like that, but we had some, and that was definitely, you know, one avenue to look. But I always say going off market, reaching those sellers that are, who don't know that they want to sell their property are the best places to reach a deal, because you're not competing with lots of different people to get there. Even with short sales and foreclosures, those get listed in the MLS, you know, they're at the courthouse. So there's still a large market of people going after the same deals.
Okay. So you pursue financial independence as well, correct?
Yep, that's my passion.
Sweet. So what has that been like as a parent to also be pursuing?
Oh, gosh, my kids are so over me talking to them about stuff. They're only 10. So, you know, it's like I want them to be like little mini adults and really like understand it and save their money and learn how to invest and stuff like that. And, you know, I don't want to buy junk, you know, so it's really hard to, I think, balance sometimes, you know, letting the kids just have fun and, you know, do what they want to do with their money and stuff. You know, I did have this epiphany when they were probably only 5 or 6 years old. We had gone on a trip with their grandparents, and their great grandparents were there. Well, at the end of the trip, the great grandparents gave them each $20, and we all parted ways. And we had stopped somewhere as a family, and I think we were in downtown Savannah. And, you know, we're in this little store, and one of my kids asked for something. I said, well, great grandma just gave you $20. You can buy it if you want to. And she looked at me and she was like, I don't want to spend my money on that. And I was like, oh, you want to spend my money on that? I was like, so it wasn't good enough, you know, to spend your own money. But then I just had this brilliant moment of give them control of their money and they will spend a lot less. So from that point on, I started giving them an allowance, you know, it's $5 a week. And you know, and I can see the differences between the kids. You know, they're twins, and one of them is definitely a saver, and the other one, she's not a terrible spender, but she definitely spends more freely. But it's so nice to be able to walk into Target, and, you know, I've got their little debit cards and stuff on me, and every time they want something, I always say yes. I was like, you know, you can buy whatever you want with your money. So, and they hate it, but, you know, but it really does work, I think, to get them thinking about what's really important.
Yeah,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, once you tell them they got to pay for that candy bar,
yeah, they don't want it anymore.
Maybe I don't want it.
Yeah, it's like, oh, it's really interesting. I mean, really, I mean, I probably spend 75% less on crap, which is really nice, because I also don't like a lot of clutter and stuff in the house. You know, and these toys tend to get played with for a day or two and then forgotten. So it's just nice to not have as much of that in the house.
Okay. Have you had any other challenges specifically around pursuing FI with your children?
They are definitely anchors when it comes to that. It's like you're trying to, you know, do stuff. But I feel like every time I leave the house with my kids, it costs me $100. You know, it's like if I take them to the arcade, there goes $100. Or if I take them, you know, to the roller skating rink or something, there's still an arcade around, so it still costs money. So I just really try to limit taking them out to too many places. But, you know, we do things that I enjoy a lot, like a lot of travel and stuff. And you know, that FI journey does become much slower when you've got dependents, of course, on you. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to save money for their college. And, you know, what is the best route to take? Should I send them to community college for a couple of years? Like, does that, you know, does that take away from their experiences versus, you know, is that stuff worth paying for? And I don't know, because they're only 10 and maybe they'll be great students and, you know, go to college and maybe they'll drop out. I have no idea. So.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, how did you first find out about FI?
I think when I found out it was a movement was, I think I came across the Mr. Money Mustache blog. And, you know, here's this guy who's being like real extreme about it, but kind of in a way where it's like, oh, I could probably do that, or at least a lot of that. You know, it's like, yeah, maybe I'm not going to build my own house from scratch, but I can, you know, maybe do some of my own little home repairs. I'm handy enough, and YouTube teaches you a lot and stuff. So, you know, it's sometimes it's just kind of like maybe not taking the easy way out. So that's where I first like really got into FI as a movement. But my dad was just a really, you know, just personal finance minded person. So he taught me a lot growing up. You know, when I got my first job, I had to learn how to do my own taxes, like literally on a sheet of paper. We would go to the library and pick up the tax forms, come home, he'd show me how to do my taxes and stuff, you know. And, you know, he just really taught me a lot of that stuff at a young age. My mom would sit at the kitchen table with me and I'd watch her pay her bills. So it's like, I knew how much the mortgage was and I knew how much the electricity bill was and stuff. So, you know, when I got to college and I was off on my own, I think I had a pretty strong understanding of, you know, what finances were and what it looked like, how important credit was and having a good credit score, you know, not blowing your money. And I still made really stupid mistakes. And, you know, my parents had to bail me out a few times anyways. But, you know, so it's like even having a very strong background and knowledge base doesn't necessarily mean you're going to always make the best decisions along the way. You know, kids are dumb.
Yeah, you know, but I think mistakes are part of the journey, right?
Yeah, and you live and you learn. It's like I realize along the way, like I probably bought too many cars, you know, like I just get bored of a car and then go off and buy a new one and trade that old one in. And, you know, and it's like when I realized like how much money I could have saved along the way not doing that. Now it's like, okay, well, now I finally do have money and I probably could afford to buy a nice car. But now I'm driving like a 10-year-old minivan because, I don't know, maybe I'm just trying to make up for the other ones. you know, but those types of things just don't excite me anymore either. It's like, I've been kind of in the market for a new car, but nothing really seems worth $50,000 when I know I could use that $50,000 and buy another investment property or invest it in something else. So it's like, well, part of me kind of feels like I've done well enough, so I shouldn't drive such a shitty car, but I also don't want to spend the money on a new one. So here I am just stuck with this minivan. So.
I mean, that's money, right? Like that. It's never a bad thing. And I agree. Like that's kind of like my mentality too. It's like, you know, like I could go get another property or like use it as a down payment on multifamily or whatever. Exactly. Right.
It's like, you know, it just seems like a waste to spend money on, you know, these big purchases and stuff. And so, you know, I did have enough cash saved up to buy a car. And like I said, nothing was exciting me. And so I found that camper van that I'm sure you've seen on my Facebook often. And you know, that was the same price as the Tesla I was looking at as well, but I was like, oh, the Tesla doesn't really seem that exciting to me, but the camper van, that does. I was like, that's like a little tiny home on wheels. Like I'm all about that.
Yeah. And then you can rent that out.
You can't, you know, I went to like a little seminar where they talked about that. I think Outdoorsy was hosting it. So learned a little bit about that. What were you saying, Austin?
No, I was just going to say, have you taken any fun trips in your camper van?
All of the fun trips. So that Disney trip I was telling you about, I actually camped at Disney. They have a campsite on property. I took the kids out west over the summer, and we hit up a lot of the national parks and stuff out there. So we did an almost 3-week trip where I drove like, I don't know, I think it was like 11,000 miles. It was something ridiculous. So maybe the step, I can't remember. But yeah, I made it all the way as far west as Nevada. So I didn't get all the way to the other coast, but almost. Yeah. And then I take it all the time for like, you know, just short weekend trips and stuff. I've been to the mountains a couple of times around here and some of the state parks and stuff that we have in North Carolina and Virginia and South Carolina. Took it to Florida. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. I've only had it since February. I think it's already got 28,000 miles on it. So.
Yeah. So pursuing FI, you know, it's not really a lifestyle for everyone, but has it fit around your lifestyle?
I can see where I differ from my peers sometimes, you know, when we're traveling certain places and stuff and I'm using credit card points and, you know, travel hacking and stuff like that. And other people are just like paying for like expensive places that maybe aren't available through, you know, Chase services or something like that. So, you know, I definitely see that people choose to spend their money in different ways, but you know, that's okay. Like, I don't really judge, you know, if somebody wants to blow money on first class tickets, like that's fine. Like I blow money on a lot of things that I'm sure other people, wouldn't. So there's that, but, you know, and I live in a nice neighborhood where everybody has things and I probably drive the shittiest car on the block and, and that's okay. Like, you know, some of the people have their kids in private schools and, you know, I was like, a lot of people travel and, but of course I do the same amount of traveling. So I definitely don't judge that one. But yeah, I think there is kind of a balance between like doing what everyone else does and just kind of keeping up with normal, people. And then, you know, kind of having that Mr. Money message, like, angel on your other shoulder going, nope, you can not spend money on that. You can do that yourself, you know, or that's a waste. So.
Yeah. So also do you have a budget? Like, do you keep a budget? Cause there are a lot of people in the FI community that I found out actually
don't keep a budget, but I do keep track of my spending. So I use just like a very simple spending app. I think it's literally called Spending. And so I write down everything that I spend as I spend it. And then maybe once a month or so, I'll go through my credit card bills and just kind of make sure I didn't miss writing something down. But that does kind of clue you into like, okay, this is how much I'm spending on groceries a month and going out to eat. And if you're overspending in certain areas, you can kind of, you know, it's in black and white and right in front of you. So you can't deny it. But no, I don't budget. So, you know, I know a lot of people use YNAB and stuff like that, but that's probably a little too in the weeds for, I think, at the point that I'm at.
Yeah, I agree. I hate budgeting. Yeah, I have a set just dollar amount. As long as I don't go over that, I'm happy. But, like, I can't keep track of, all right, I'm going to spend this much on this, this much on this. I'm like, nope, if I overspend here, I'll underspend somewhere else. As long as I stay
when I was living more paycheck to paycheck in my early 20s, you know, it's like, okay, I know it's like, hey, I get a paycheck for $850 and I've got to make it last for the next 2 weeks. So, you know, you kind of do have to budget a bit more then, but it's just not nearly as important now. It's more about tracking and just kind of seeing where the holes are or where the waste happens.
I agree. Now, also, do you ever think you'll quote unquote retire, or are you already doing what you plan on doing?
What I've realized is that, at least for me, it's going to be very fluid because I own my own business. You know, I'm a realtor and, you know, I've always have worked for myself, or at least for a long time, I've worked for myself. And so it's like, well, if I don't want to work today, I just don't, or I don't schedule anything, or, you know, or if I have a busy week, then, you know, I'm just working a ton and you just kind of do the work as it happens or comes to me. And so now with the real estate market being super slow, like I've had a few months before, I haven't had a whole lot of work to do. And it's like, you know, I think that could be unnerving to some people, but I saved a lot along the way. I mean, really, I was prepared for a market correction when COVID first happened. You know, the real estate market just like came to a halt like in March. And I maybe sold 2 houses in March and April and May each. And so, you know, it was super slow. And I was like, okay, this is the correction we've all been waiting for. And that made sense because COVID was a big, weird thing that happened. So I was like, all right, surely this is what's going to make the real estate market fall apart for a while. So, you know, I was glad that I'd been saving and investing all the way up until then. And then the government pumped a bunch of money into the market and it went crazy. And I had the best 2 years of sales in my life. So it was kind of like, well, you know, that really kind of padded what I needed. And so it's like, I think if I were to just call it quits and retire today, you know, I'd have to adjust some things, but I'd call myself maybe lean FI. So it's like, I won't necessarily have to work, which makes the motivation to like run out there and, you know, do a bunch of stuff kind of low. So it's like, I'm kind of in this like weird semi-retirement, you know, don't feel like I need to like run out and work right now. But that being said, if the market picks back up and everyone's kind of ready to buy and sell again, then I'd be right there, you know, ready to do it. My kids are only 10 years old. So my dream of when I do retire is to like slow travel around the United States and then around the world. And so, you know, since I have 2 kids that are going to be at home for the next 8 years, at least, then, you know, I'm kind of stuck here too with them. So, you know, so I might as well work and make some extra money, while I'm kind of waiting for them to flee the nest. You know, so that's kind of like what my version of retirement looks like. But in the meantime, just like really slowing down and not working from the time I get up to the time I go to bed kind of feels like a little retirement already. So.
Yeah, I absolutely get it. And, you know, with our community, right, like in Simplify and other FI groups, you know, I feel like you can make enough friends to where you have the ability to like always have a place to stay, right? And like you can just make so many friends, and then someone's like, oh, hey, like come down to Florida, or hey, go come to Tennessee, or and you're like, okay,
yeah, exactly. Like, this is like, you know, there are a lot of ways I think to do things very, very cheaply. It's like, yeah, you can retire to Thailand and, you know, live super cheap. I could probably do that and not have to adjust a whole lot. But I'd be living in Thailand, which would be a very big adjustment. So, you know, there's just so many ways, I think, to do this. And, you know, that number I think that you need is just so fluid. And there's, you know, a lot of assumptions you have to make along the way, too. And those assumptions can turn out to be wrong and you've got to adjust. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to retirement, but I don't, you know, I kind of feel like I'm somewhere in the beginning stages of that anyways, but it's going to come in stages.
Okay. Do you have an FI number?
Yeah, I think, I don't know that it's really based on a whole lot, but I was thinking if I had 3.5, that is probably, you know, at a 3.5% safe withdrawal rate, then that would be $100,000 a year. I was like, that seems like enough because you're not trying to save anymore. So
Okay. Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest issues that I'm running into is, like, on my journey. Like, 2022 has been kind of a rough year. There were times when I got kind of, like, tossed off the path of savings. I used to, in, like, previous years, I had, like, a 70% savings rate. And yeah, this year it was, like, 20 to 30, awesome, maybe. And I just feel bad.
I said, that's still awesome, though.
What? Yeah, but I know. It's, like, the comparison is, like, the thief of joy, exactly. Right? It's like you always think you could be doing better, but I'm just used to saving so much of my paycheck for retirement that, like, nothing else matters to me because the one thing that I want is my time back.
Yeah, exactly. You're buying your time back, and that's, so to me, like, very valuable, and I think it's totally worth, you know, scrimping and saving in certain areas. But, you know, for me, I don't like to lose the joy along the way, so it's like I, you know, let go of the things that don't really matter to me, and honestly, like, buying stuff, while I think in the very, like, moment bring me some joy, you know, like, oh, I've got a new outfit, like, that sounds good. And then I stick it in my closet with the other, like, 400 pieces of clothes in there. I'm like, you know, all of these things brought me, like, some little brief moment of joy. But now when I look at it, it just looks like clutter and, you know, a waste and stuff like that. So I think, you know, when you really spend money on things that do bring you that joy and you do get some value out of it, then I think those things are completely worth spending as much as you want to spend on it to your ability. But letting go of those things that really don't matter don't add any kind of value to your life.
Yeah, I agree. I like to, like, live very minimalistic because it's like, you know, you don't need a lot of things to survive. As I see with my TV behind me. So I've actually had this TV for like 3 years now, and it's just come with me.
Oh, that's got its money's worth. You're good.
Yeah. Right. But in the future, you know, as we've seen with companies like Zillow and Redfin, Open Door, kind of trying to automate in a way the home buying process, do you think that there will be less of a need for realtors in the future? Do you think more companies are going to realize that, hey, like, we could do it, or hey, like, take Zillow as an example of, like, to not try to get
the market? Yeah, I think the automation part of it really. I think you kind of need the human element in real estate to dial in. And, you know, Zillow's great. Like, if you live in a cookie cutter neighborhood and, you know, every house is roughly the same, then Zillow giving you your value is probably fairly accurate. But most of us don't live in places like that. I mean, even my own neighborhood, which I would consider a fairly cookie cutter, you know, a lot of us have the same floor plans, but we also have a section of townhomes and a section of smaller single family homes and larger single family homes and, you know, townhomes with two car garages, townhomes with no car, you know, they're all in different sections of the neighborhood and, you know, really command different prices per square foot and stuff like that. So even in my neighborhood where, you know, each section is cookie cutter, it still gives us weird values and stuff because it's pulling in from just an area around. And my neighborhood, it's a nice neighborhood. It's close to downtown Raleigh, so it's like a nice neighborhood plopped down in the middle of very low income housing and stuff. So, you know, we are the only, like, you know, affluent neighborhood within a few miles. So, you know, so all of these things, like, adjust those algorithms and stuff. And it's like, if you don't know the neighborhood, even another agent who doesn't know the neighborhood here probably couldn't give you the value as well as I could, just because I live here and I know the neighborhood and I know these different sections command different values and stuff. So, you know, I do think sometimes just having that human element is necessary. And, you know, we're real estate investors. So, like, we understand this process really well, and we do this multiple times. As a real estate investor who's done it many times, maybe you don't need an agent, you know, and you're totally fine with that process on your own. But most people buy and sell once every 5 to 10 years. And so, and things change in those 5 to 10 years. And I think those people are just not nearly as comfortable doing it without the help. And also, you know, the places like Open Door and stuff like that, like, I think they do well while the market is going up. And, you know, and I think if the market were always going up, those companies would probably do very well. But again, it's a cycle. And what I'm seeing now, at least in my area, Open Door bought a ton of properties and overpaid by quite a bit. And they're all sitting on the market now with huge price reductions. And I've went back and checked to see how much they paid for a lot of these properties. And almost all of them that I checked, what they have it listed for is less than what they paid for it. So, and it's still sitting on the market, not selling. So it's like, I know they're losing money big time. Or at least they are in my area. So I'd be kind of surprised to see them stay in business if this cycle stays down for more than a year, which I think it will.
Do Do you have any advice for newcomers to real estate investing? Like, what is like one thing to like get them started?
But it's like, I see so many people fall into this stat analysis paralysis, you know, and they analyze deals to death. Like, I have clients now that I talked to, you know, 3 or 5 years ago, even they still haven't bought anything. And it's like, they've missed like a whole real estate cycle. And it's like, what are you doing? It's like, you're wasting time, you know, analyzing every deal, waiting for some very perfect property to come along. And it's like, I know the first two properties I bought, like I knew nothing about real estate investing. All I knew is that these two houses had come up in a neighborhood that was near NC State University. And I had friends that went to NC State at the time. And it was a neighborhood that they liked to try to find homes to rent in. So I knew it was popular with students, was basically what it got down to. Other than that, I didn't know how much it was really going to rent for. I was like, well, you know, I just thought, well, I'll buy these two houses, somebody will rent them. And that was pretty much the extent of my thought processes. And they did. And I think I paid like $160 for one and $170 for the other. And they rented for like $1,100. So even way back then, it was not even close to the 1% rule. I didn't know what I was doing, but you know, it still worked out. It's like now they rent for $1,600 or $1,700 each. And that $160 or $170 that I paid for them are now worth like $350. So I'm not mad about it. Like, I don't, you know, it's like maybe not the best investment I could have made at the time, but it worked out. And, you know, while real estate doesn't always go up, you know, it does at least keep up with inflation. And honestly, like, yes, if you go back and look at charts, like it is going up, like there's going to be some ups and some downs, but you know, the track is up just like the stock market.
Now, is real estate and the market the only two things you invest in?
I also do private lending. So I help some local flippers, you know, fund their projects and stuff. I also have invested passively in a syndication. They actually just sold that apartment building a few months ago. So I'm in and out of that one now. But I also have invested with like another company that does private lending. So that one's like not secured because I don't have an individual house that I'm lending on, but I gave the money to this company and they hold it for two year cycles. And then I recently just invested in a fund that is buying like mobile home parks and RV parks. Of course, I got my camper van, so now I'm all interested in that. And, you know, with the market going in the direction that it is, I do think that that asset class is probably going to fare pretty well because, you know, that's what a lot of like lower income people will resort to if they can't live in a regular house. So let's see. So yeah, stock market. When I say stock market, it's really just, you know, Vanguard index funds. I think I have like one individual stock and I don't even remember buying it. I just like opened up my E-Trade account. I had money in Nike and I was like, when did I buy Nike? I was like, it was up though. I was like, all right, well, I don't remember doing that. And then treasury bonds. So I recently, with the treasury bond rates, were up over those last two cycles. So I invested, what I could into that. And I think that's up. No crypto. It's funny you bring that up. I guess something must have happened on the news. My mom called me before we got on this call. And she's like, she's a little, just picture a little Korean lady who's, you know, in her mid-60s. And she's like, Dawn, she's like, did you invest in cryptocurrency? And I was like, no. Oh, good, because he got arrested. I was like, ooh, the guy. I was like, I don't know what guy she talked about, but somebody, you know, got arrested, I guess, for defrauding people. I was like, no, I'm not invested in crypto because it's just not really something I understand very well. So I was like, I don't really get it. I know a lot of people have made a lot of money, but if I put money in, it really would just be, you know, shooting a dart because I have no idea what it even means or what it does. So I'm not. Are you invested in crypto?
Yeah.
I
do remember a friend had approached me like right when Bitcoin had first become a thing. And he was like, oh, we could do like Bitcoin mining. You just buy these like servers and you have to pay a larger electricity bill. And he's like explaining it to me. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, and I was like, this sounds weird. I don't know what you're saying. And so I just didn't do anything with it, you know? And then of course, like looking back, I was like, I probably should have done that. But
well, you know, it goes to the thing of like, if you don't understand it, don't do it because that's how you lose money. So, I mean, like your judgment at the time was like, hey, like, I don't know anything about this. I've never heard of this.
Yeah, it's like, I missed out on that, but then I gained in some other things. So it's like, well, you know, I think that hindsight's great for everybody. We all know what we should have done. But yeah, at the time, you're just working with the information you've got.
So do you currently buy properties in other parts of North Carolina, and do you have other partners?
I haven't bought anything else in other parts of North Carolina. I do pay attention to the Fayetteville market, though, because we work in that market. My business partners bought a few things down there. I grew up there, so I'm familiar with it. So I would not be opposed to buying something in the Fayetteville market. Briefly consider doing like short-term rentals in the mountains or the beach, but I've got some friends and stuff that do that, and they do well, but I think I just kind of decided I don't want another job. So I decided not to take that on. I haven't really done any kind of, what's the word? Long distance investing.
Gotcha. Okay. The only reason I'm asking is because I'm always looking for investors, and I don't have the capital at the moment.
Where are you trying to invest?
More than willing to do the work. Charlotte, just because I don't want to hire a property manager, and I would love to add other Airbnbs to my portfolio, and I can do the work, but I just am lacking on the capital.
Yeah,
absolutely. So, with you know, pursuing financial independence, you know, there are always going to be goods and bads to it. Have you read any good books that you recommend?
You know, it's funny. I was actually just having this discussion with somebody else because my kids are young, so I'm not going to do this yet. But I read somewhere that somebody had the idea of paying their children to read like certain finance books. And I was like, oh, okay, which ones are the ones that I would want them to read? I'd be happy to pay them to do it and get that, you know, knowledge base. And of course, Rich Dad, Poor Dad comes up. I like Scott Trench's book, Set for Life, as well. You know, I was trying to think of some ones that are kind of geared towards younger people that maybe I could have them do as like a teenager. So I hadn't come up with anything, but that was definitely on my like list of things to do. It's like come up with like a good reading list to get them moving. There's a few that I kind of liked along the way, and some of them are like more motivational than they are like practical, you know, things to do, but you know, things like Atomic Habits or Getting Things Done or that kind of stuff, you know, for me, it's more just like trying to like, just keep moving instead of getting real comfortable. Cause I have a tendency to just get comfortable and go, okay, well, this is good enough and I don't need to work that hard anymore. But you know, I'm only 43. I've got like plenty of time to do things. So it's like, I also don't like to just sit around and do nothing. So when I say I don't want to work hard, it's like, it's because I want to spend my time traveling or just going and doing other fun things and stuff. But when I do find myself here and I'm not doing stuff, I'm like, all right, I need some work. So, but let's see, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I like Secrets of a Millionaire Mind. One that I have on my list that I haven't read yet was I'll Teach You to Be Rich. But I've got that one downloaded and ready to go. What am I forgetting? Yes. Yep.
Simple Past Wealth.
4-hour work week.
If you ever are on YouTube, Our Rich Journey is fantastic. Yeah, it's a couple and their two children. They retired in Portugal, I think at like 33.
All right, I'm gonna write that one down.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I watch like all of their videos. it's just so good. Like, I love their videos. I love their content. Alon and Christina are just fantastic people, in my opinion. So I think those are really great resources overall. Greg, do you have any questions?
I do not.
Okay. Well, Don, we'll let you get back to the rest of your day. And thank you for coming on the show.
Good to meet you, Austin.
Yeah, over video.
I know.
We'll have to set something up in person.
Like, little baby steps closer to meeting my internet friends.
No, it's weird when you meet them in person because, like, obviously, like, all you see is a video. But then, like, when you meet them in person, you're like, oh, like, I imagine you're different. Yeah, right? Well, this has been another episode of Life, Love, and the Pursuit of FI with your hosts, Austin Culp.
And Greg Gaskin.
And our guest, Don Brennigan. Thanks again, Don. Have a good rest of your day, everyone.